another. When he crossed the line from paganism to Christianity, he arrived in the territory of a truth beyond further challenge. Explanations succeed only by convincing resistant hearers of their error. If you will not hear my explanations until you are suspicious of your own truths, you will not accept my explanations until you are convinced of your error. Explanation is an antagonistic encounter that succeeds by defeating an opponent. It possesses the same dynamic of resentment found in other finite play. I will press my explanations on you because I need to show that I do not live in the error that I think others think I do. Whoever wins this struggle is privileged with the claim to true knowledge. Knowledge has been arrived at. It is the outcome of this engagement. Its winners have the uncontested power to make certain statements of fact. They are to be listened to. In those areas appropriate to the contests now concluded, winners possess a knowledge that no longer can be challenged. Knowledge, therefore, is like property. It must be published, declared, or in some other way so displayed that others cannot but take account of it. It must stand in their way. It must be emblematic, pointing backward at its possessor's competitive skill. So close are knowledge and property that they are often thought to be continuous. Those who are entitled to knowledge feel they should be granted property as well, and those who are entitled to property believe a certain knowledge goes with it. Scholars demand higher salaries for their publishable successes. Industrialists sit on university boards. 75. If explanation, to be successful, must be oblivious to the silence of nature, it must also, in its success, impose silence on its listeners. Imposed silence is the first consequence of the master player's triumph. What one wins in a title is the privilege of magisterial speech. The privilege of magisterial speech is the highest honor attaching to any title. We expect the first act of a winner to be a speech. The first act of the loser may also be a speech, but it will be a speech to concede victory, to declare there will be no further challenge to the winner. It is a speech that promises to silence the loser's voice. The silence to which the losers pledge themselves is the silence of obedience. Losers have nothing to say, nor have they an audience who would listen. The vanquished are effectively of one will with the victors, and of one mind. They are completely incapable of opposition, and therefore without any otherness whatsoever. The victorious do not speak with the defeated. They speak for the defeated. Husbands speak for wives in the finite family, and parents for their children. Kings speak for the realm, governors for the state, popes for the church. Indeed, the titled as titled cannot speak with anyone. It is chiefly in magisterial speech that the power of winners resides. To be powerful is to have one's words obeyed. It is only by magisterial speech that the emblematic property of winners can be safeguarded. Those entitled to their possessions have the privilege of calling the police, calling up an army, to force the recognition of their emblems. The power of gods is known principally through their utterances. The sicut dixit Dominus, thus says the Lord, is always a signal for ritual silence. The speech of a god can be so perfectly expressive of that god's power that the god and its speech become identical. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. One is speechless before a god, or silent before a winner, because it no longer matters to others what one has to say. To lose a contest is to become obedient. To become obedient is to lose one's listeners. The silence of obedience is an unheard silence. It is the silence of death. For this reason, the demand for obedience is inherently evil. The silence of nature is the possibility of language. By subduing nature, the gods give it their own voice. But in making nature an opponent, they make all their listeners opponents. By refusing the silence of nature, they demand the silence of obedience. The unspeakability of nature is therefore transformed into the unspeakability of language itself. 76. Infinite speech is that mode of discourse that consistently reminds us of the unspeakability of nature. It bears no claim to truth, originating from nothing but the genius of the speaker. Infinite speech is therefore not about anything. It is always to someone. It is not command but address. It belongs entirely to the speakable. That language is not about anything gives it its status as metaphor. Metaphor does not point at something there. Never shall we find the kingdom of daylight's dauphin in one place or another. It is not the role of metaphor to draw our sight to what is there, but to draw our vision toward what is not there, and, indeed, cannot be anywhere. Metaphor is horizontal, reminding us that it is one's vision that is limited, and not what one is viewing. The meaning of a finite speaker's discourse lies in what precedes its utterance, what is already the case, and therefore is the case whether or not it is spoken. The meaning of an infinite speaker's discourse lies in what comes of its utterance, that is, whatever is the case because it is spoken. Finite language exists complete before it is spoken. There is first a language, then we learn to speak it. Infinite language exists only as it is spoken. There is first a language, when we learn to speak it. It is in this sense that infinite discourse always arises from a perfect silence. Finite speakers come to speech with their voices already trained and rehearsed. They must know what they are doing with the language before they can speak it. Infinite speakers must wait to see what is done with their language by the listeners before they can know what they have said. Infinite speech does not expect the hearer to see what is already known to the speaker, but to share a vision the speaker could not have had without the response of the listener. Speaker and listener understand each other, not because they have the same knowledge about something, and not because they have established a likeness of mind, but because they know how to go on with each other. Wittgenstein. 77. Because it is address, attending always on the response of the addressed, infinite speech has the form of listening. Infinite speech does not end in the obedient silence of the hearer, but continues by way of the attentive silence of the speaker. It is not a silence into which speech has died, but a silence from which speech is born. Infinite speakers do not give voice to another, but receive it from another. Infinite speakers do not therefore appeal to a world as audience, do not speak before a world, but present themselves as an audience by way of talking with others. Finite speech informs another about the world, for the sake of being heard. Infinite speech forms a world about the other, for the sake of listening. It is for this reason that the gods, insofar as they speak as the lords of this world, magisterially, speak before this world and are therefore unable to change it. Such gods cannot create a world, but can only be creations of a world, can only be idols. A god cannot create a world and be magisterial within it. The religions which represent divinity as commanding, whenever it has the power to do so, seem false. Even though they are monotheistic, they are idolatrous, vile. A god can create a world only by listening. Were the gods to address us, it would not be to bring us to silence through their speech, but to bring us to speech through their silence. The contradiction of finite speech is that it must end by being heard. The paradox of infinite speech is that it continues only because it is a way of listening. Finite speech ends with a silence of closure. Infinite speech begins with a disclosure of silence. 78. Storytellers do not convert their listeners. They do not move them into the territory of a superior truth. Ignoring the issue of truth and falsehood altogether, they offer only vision. Storytelling is therefore not combative. It does not succeed or fail. A story cannot be obeyed. Instead of placing one body of knowledge against another, Storytellers invite us to return from knowledge to thinking, from a bounded way of looking to a horizontal way of seeing. Infinite speakers are Plato's poietai, taking their place in the historical. Storytellers enter the historical not when their speaking is full of anecdotes about actual persons, or when they appear as characters in their own tales, but when in their speaking we begin to see the narrative character of our lives. The stories they tell touch us. What we thought was an accidental sequence of experiences suddenly takes the dramatic shape of unresolved narrative. There is no narrative without structure or plot. In a great story, this structure seems like fate, like an inescapable judgment descending on its still unaware heroes, a great metaphysical causality that crowds out all room for choice. Fate arises not as a limitation on our freedom, but as a manifestation of our freedom, testimony that choice is consequent. The exercise of your freedom cannot prevent the exercise of my own freedom, but it can determine the context in which I am to act freely. You cannot make choices for me, but you can largely determine what my choices will be about. Great stories explore the drama of this deeper touching of one free person by another. They are therefore genuinely sexual dramas, astounding us once more with the magic of origins. The myth of Oedipus is one of many great sexual narratives in the cultural treasury of the West that plays on the dramatic relation of fate and origin. Once Oedipus had impulsively killed Laius, not knowing he was his own father, he was carried ahead by ambition and lust into marriage with the dead man's wife, unaware of her true identity. We can read this as fate, or we can read it as one act of willfulness that leads to another. Oedipus has taken the posture of the master player executing terminal moves. But the moves are not terminal. Oedipus is able to bring nothing to an end, even the act of blinding himself, meant as a kind of concluding gesture, only brings him to a higher vision. What Oedipus sees is not what the gods have done to him, but what he has done. He learns that what had been limited was his vision, and not what he was viewing. His blinding is an unveiling, and like all unveiling, it is self-unveiling. Confronted in the end with nothing but his own genius, Oedipus is finally able to touch. The end of his story is a beginning. What raises this story into the historical is not just that Oedipus sees. It is that we see that he sees. We become listeners who see that we are listening and therefore participating in a now enlarged drama of origins. Nothing is explained here. On the contrary, what we see is that everything remains still to be said. 79. There is a risk here of supposing that because we know our lives to have the character of narrative, we also know what that narrative is. If I were to know the full story of my life, I would then have translated it back into explanation. It is though I could stand as audience to myself, seeing the opening scene and the final scene at the same time, as though I could see my life in its entirety. In doing so, I would be performing it, not living it. Societal theorists are tempted into the belief that they know the story of a civilization. They can script its final scene of triumph or defeat. It is by way of such end-of-history thinking that the discovered laws of behavior to which persons conform become the scripted laws of behavior to which they must conform. True storytellers do not know their own story. What they listen to in their poesis is the disclosure that wherever there is closure, there is the possibility of a new opening, that they do not die at the end, but in the course of play. Neither do they know anyone else's story in its entirety. The primary work of historians is to open all cultural termini, to reveal continuity where we have assumed something has ended, to remind us that no one's life and no culture can be known, as one would know a poema, but only learned, as one would learn a poiesis. Historians become infinite speakers when they see that whatever begins in freedom cannot end in necessity. Chapter 6. We control nature for societal reasons. 80. We control nature for societal reasons. The control of nature advances with our ability to predict the outcome of natural processes. Inasmuch as predictions are but explanations in reverse, it is possible that they will be quite as combative as explanations. Indeed, prediction is the most highly developed skill of the master player, for without it, control of an opponent is all the more difficult. It follows that our domination of nature is meant to achieve not certain natural outcomes, but certain societal outcomes. A small group of physicists, using calculations of the highest known abstraction, uncovered a predictable sequence of subatomic reactions that led directly to the construction of a thermonuclear bomb. It is true that the successful detonation of the bomb proved the predictions of the physicists, but it is also true that we did not explode the bomb to prove them correct. We exploded it to control the behavior of millions of persons and to bring our relations with them to a certain closure. What this example shows is not that we can exercise power over nature, but that our attempt to do so masks our desire for power over each other. This raises a question as to the cultural consequences of abandoning the strategy of power in our attitude toward nature. The alternative attitudes toward nature can be characterized in a rough way, by saying that the result of approaching nature as a hostile other whose designs are basically inimical to our interests is the machine, while the result of learning to discipline ourselves to consist with the deepest discernible patterns of natural order is the garden. Machine is used here as inclusive of technology, and not as an example of it, as a way of drawing attention to the mechanical rationality of technology. We might be surprised by the technological devices that spring from the imagination of gifted inventors and engineers, but there is nothing surprising in the technology itself. The physicist's bomb is as thoroughly mechanical as the Neanderthal's lever, each the exercise of calculable cause and effect sequences. Garden does not refer to the bounded plot at the edge of the house or the margin of the city. This is not a garden one lives beside, but a garden one lives within. It is a place of growth, of maximized spontaneity. To garden is not to engage in a hobby or an amusement. It is to design a culture capable of adjusting to the widest possible range of surprise in nature. Gardeners are acutely attentive to the deep patterns of natural order, but are also aware that there will always be much lying beyond their vision. Gardening is a horizontal activity. Machine and garden are not absolutely opposed to each other. Machinery can exist in the garden quite as finite games can be played within an infinite game. The question is not one of restricting machines from the garden, but asking whether a machine serves the interest of the garden, or the garden the interest of the machine. We are familiar with a kind of mechanized gardening that has the appearance of high productivity. But looking closely, we can see that what is intended is not the encouragement of natural spontaneity, but its harnessing. 81. The most elemental difference between the machine and the garden is that one is driven by a force which must be introduced from without, the other grown by an energy which originates from within itself. Certainly, machines of extraordinary complexity have been built. Spacecraft, for example, that sustain themselves for months in the void while performing complicated functions with great accuracy. But no machine has been made, nor can one be made, that has the source of its spontaneity within itself. A machine must be designed, constructed, and fueled. Certainly, gardens can be treated with such a range of chemical and technological strategies that we can speak of raising food, and of the food we have raised as produce. But no way has been found, or can be found, by which organic growth can be forced from without. The application of fertilizers, herbicides, and any number of other substances does not alter growth but allows growth. It is meant to consist with natural growth. A plant cannot be designed or constructed. Though we seem to give it fuel in the form of rich earth and appropriate nutrients, we depend on the plant to make use of the fuel by way of its own vitality. A machine depends on its designer and its operator both for the supply of fuel and its consumption. A machine has not the merest trace of its own spontaneity or vitality. Vitality cannot be given, only found. 82. Just as nature has no outside, it has no inside. It is not divided within itself and cannot therefore be used for or against itself. There is no inherent opposition of the living and the non-living within nature. Neither is more or less natural than the other. The use of agricultural poisons, for example, will surely kill selected organisms. It will arrest the spontaneity of living entities. But it is not an unnatural act. Nature has not been changed. All that changes is the way we discipline ourselves to consist with natural order. Our freedom in relation to nature is not the freedom to change nature. It is not the possession of power over natural phenomena. It is the freedom to change ourselves. We are perfectly free to design a culture that will turn on the awareness that vitality cannot be given but only found, that the given patterns of spontaneity in nature are not only to be respected, but to be celebrated. Although natural order is the common expression, it has something of a veiling quality about it. More properly speaking, it is not the order of nature, but its irreducible spontaneity with which we find ourselves contending. That nature has no outside and no inside. That it suffers no opposition to itself. That it is not moved by a natural influence is not the expression of an order so much as it is the display of a perfect indifference on nature's part to all matters cultural. Nature's source of movement is always from within itself. Indeed, it is itself. And it is radically distinct from our own source of movement. This is not to say that, possessing no order, nature is chaotic. It is neither chaotic nor ordered. Chaos and order describe the cultural experience of nature, the degree to which nature's indifferent spontaneity seems to agree with our current manner of cultural self-control. A hurricane or a plague, or the overpopulation of the earth, will seem chaotic to those whose cultural expectations are damaged by them, and orderly to those whose expectations have been confirmed by them. 83. The paradox in our relation to nature is that the more deeply a culture respects the indifference of nature, the more creatively it will call upon its own spontaneity in response. The more clearly we remind ourselves that we can have no unnatural influence on nature, the more our culture will embody a freedom to embrace surprise and unpredictability. Human freedom is not a freedom over nature, it is the freedom to be natural, that is, to answer to the spontaneity of nature with our own spontaneity. Though we are free to be natural, we are not free by nature. We are free by culture, by history. The contradiction in our relation to nature is that the more vigorously we attempt to force its agreement with our own designs, the more subject we are to its indifference, the more vulnerable to its unseeing forces. The more power we exercise over natural process, the more powerless we become before it. In a matter of months, we can cut down a rainforest that took tens of thousands of years to grow. But we are helpless in repulsing the desert that takes its place. And the desert, of course, is no less natural than the forest. 84. Such contradiction is the most obvious in the matter of machinery. We make use of machines to increase our power, and therefore our control over natural phenomena. By exerting themselves no more than is necessary to operate fingertip controls, a team of workers can cut six-lane highways through mountains and dense forest, or fill in wetlands to build shopping malls. While a machine greatly aids the operator in such tasks, it also disciplines its operator. As the machine might be considered the extended arms and legs of the worker might be considered an extension of the machine. All machines, and especially very complicated machines, require operators to place themselves in a provided location and to perform functions mechanically adapted to the functions of the machine. To use the machine for control is to be controlled by the machine. To operate a machine, one must operate like a machine. Using a machine to do what we cannot do, we find we must do what the machine does. Machines do not, of course, make us into machines when we operate them. We make ourselves into machinery in order to operate them. Machinery does not steal our spontaneity from us. We set it aside ourselves. We deny our originality. There is no style in operating a machine. The more efficient the machine, the more it either limits or absorbs our uniqueness into its operation. Indeed, we come to think that the style of operation does not belong to the operator at all, but is inherent in the machine. Advertisers and manufacturers speak of their products as though they have designed style into them. Most consumer products are styled inasmuch as they actually standardize the activity or the taste of the consumer. In a perfect contradiction, we are urged to buy a styled artifact because others are also buying it. That is, we are asked to express our genius by giving up our genius. Because we make use of machinery in the belief we can increase the range of our freedom, and instead only decrease it, we use machines against ourselves. 85. Machinery is contradictory in another way. Just as we use machinery against ourselves, we also use machinery against itself. A machine is not a way of doing something. It stands in the way of doing something. When we use machines to achieve whatever it is we desire, we cannot have what we desire until we have finished with the machine, until we can rid ourselves of the mechanical means of reaching our intended outcome. The goal of technology is therefore to eliminate itself, to become silent, invisible, carefree. We do not purchase an automobile, for example, merely to own some machinery. Indeed, it is not machinery we are buying at all, but what we can have by way of it, a means of rapidly carrying us from one location to another, an object of envy for others, protection from the weather. Similarly, a radio must cease to exist as equipment and become sound. A perfect radio will draw no attention to itself, will make it seem we are in the very presence of the source of its sound. Neither do we watch a movie screen, nor look at television. We look at what is on television or in the movie, and become annoyed when the equipment intrudes, when the film is unfocused or the picture tube malfunctions. When machinery functions perfectly, it ceases to be there. But so do we. Radios and films allow us to be where we are not, and not be where we are. Moreover, machinery is veiling. It is a way of hiding our inaction from ourselves under what appear to be actions of great effectiveness. We persuade ourselves that, comfortably seated behind the wheels of our autos, shielded from every unpleasant change of weather, and raising or lowering our foot an inch or two, we have actually traveled somewhere. Such travel is not through space foreign to us, but in a space that belongs to us. We do not move from our point of departure, but with our point of departure. To be moved from our living room by an automobile whose upholstered seats differ scarcely at all from those in our living rooms, to an airport waiting room and then to the airplane where we are provided the same sort of furniture, is to have taken our origin with us. It is to have left home without leaving home. To be at home everywhere is to neutralize space. Therefore, the importance of reducing time and travel by arriving as quickly as possible, we need not feel as though we had left at all, that neither space nor time can affect us, as though they belong to us and not we to them. We do not go somewhere in a car, but arrive somewhere in a car. Automobiles do not make travel possible, but make it possible for us to move locations without traveling. Thus, the theatricality of machinery. Such movement is but a change of scenes. If effective, the machinery will see to it that we remain untouched by the elements, by other travelers, by those whose towns or lives we are traveling through. We can see without being seen, move without being touched. When most effective, the technology of communication allows us to bring the histories and the experiences of others into our home, but without changing our home. When most effective, the technology of travel allows us to pass through the histories of other persons with the comforts of home, but without changing those histories. When it is most effective, machinery will have no effect at all. 86. In still another way, is machinery contradictory? Using it against itself and against ourselves, we also use machinery against each other. I cannot use machinery without using it with another. I do not talk on the telephone. I talk with someone on the telephone. I listen to someone on the radio, drive to visit a friend, compute business transactions. To the degree that my association with you depends on such machinery, the connecting medium makes each of us an extension of itself. If your business activities cannot translate into data recognizable by my computer, I can have no business with you. If you do not live where I can drive to see you, I will find another friend. In each case, your relationship to me does not depend on my needs, but on the needs of my machinery. If to operate a machine is to operate like a machine, then we not only operate with each other like machines, we operate each other like machines. And if a machine is most effective when it has no effect, then we operate each other in such a way that we reach the outcome desired in such a way that nothing happens. The inherent hostility of machine-mediated relatedness is nowhere more evident than in the use of the most theatrical machines of all, instruments of war. All weapons are designed to affect others without affecting ourselves, to make others answerable to the technology in our control. Weapons are the equipment of finite games designed in such a way that they do not maximize the play but eliminate it. Weapons are meant not to win contests, but to end them. Killers are not victors. They are unopposed competitors, players without a game, living contradictions. This is particularly the case with the airborne electronic weaponry of the present century, where the operator deals only with the technology. Buttons, blips, lights, dials, levers, computer data, and never with the unseen opponent. Indeed, so empty of drama is the modern machinery of slaughter that it is intended to assault enemies only while they are still unseen. This reaches an extreme form in the belief that our enemies are not unseen because they are enemies, but are enemies because they are unseen. There is a logic in the instrumentality of death that leads us to killing the unseen because they are unseen. The crudest spear or sword is raised by an attacker because the independent existence of another cannot be countenanced, because the other cannot be seen as an other. Just as I insist that the condition of our friendship is your unresisting use of the telephone, I will expect the weapon in my hand to function without finding another that can resist it. Killers can suffer no suggestion that they are living into the open, that their histories are not finished, that their freedom is always a freedom with others and not over others, that it is not their vision that is limited, but what they are viewing. The fact that the technology of slaughter at vast distances has become extremely sophisticated does not culturally advance its highly trained operators over club-swinging primitives. It makes complete the blindness that was but rudimentary in the primitive. It is the supreme triumph of resentment over vision. We are the unseeing killing the unseen. Not everyone who uses machinery is a killer, but when the use of machinery springs from our attempt to respond to the indifference of nature with an indifference of our own to nature, we have begun to acquire the very indifference to persons that has led to the century's grandest crimes by its most civilized nations. 87. If indifference to nature leads to the machine, the indifference of nature leads to the garden. All culture has the form of gardening. The encouragement of spontaneity in others by way of one's own, the respect for source, and the refusal to convert source into resource. Gardeners slaughter no animals, they kill nothing. fruits, seeds, vegetables, nuts, grains, grasses, roots, flowers, herbs, berries, all are collected when they have ripened, and when their collection is in the interest of the garden's heightened and continued vitality. Harvesting respects a source, leaves it unexploited, suffers it to be as it is. Animals cannot be harvested. They mature, but they do not ripen. They are killed not when they have completed the cycle of their vitality, but when they are at the peak of their vitality. Finite gardeners, converting agriculture into commerce, raise or produce animals, or meat products, as though by machine. Animal husbandry is a science, a method of controlling growth. It assumes that animals belong to us. What is source in them is to be resource for us. Cattle are confined to pens to prevent such movement as would toughen their flesh. Geese, their feet nailed to the floor, are force-fed like machines until they can be butchered for their fattened livers. While machinery is meant to work changes without changing its operators, gardening transforms its workers. One learns how to drive a car, one learns to drive as a car. But one becomes a gardener. Gardening is not outcome-oriented. A successful harvest is not the end of a garden's existence, but only a phase of it. As any gardener knows, the vitality of a garden does not end with a harvest. It simply takes another form. Gardens do not die in the winter, but quietly prepare for another season. Gardeners celebrate variety, unlikeness, spontaneity. They understand that an abundance of styles is in the interest of vitality. The more complex the organic content of the soil, for example, that is, the more numerous its sources of change, the more vigorous its liveliness. Growth promotes growth. So also in culture. Infinite players understand that the vigor of a culture has to do with the variety of its sources, the differences within itself. The unique and the surprising are not suppressed in some persons for the strength of others. The genius in you stimulates the genius in me. One operates a machine effectively so that it disappears, giving way to results in which the machine has no part. One gardens creatively so that all the sources of the garden's vitality appear in its harvest, giving rise to a continuity in which we take an active part. 88. Inasmuch as gardens do not conclude with a harvest and are not played for a certain outcome, one never arrives anywhere with a garden. A garden is a place where growth is found. It has its own source of change. One does not bring change to a garden, but comes to a garden prepared for change, and therefore prepared to change. It is possible to deal with growth only out of growth. True parents do not see to it that their children grow in a particular way according to a preferred pattern or scripted stages, but they see to it that they grow with their children. The character of one's parenting, if it is genuinely dramatic, must be constantly altered from within as the children change from within. So too with teaching or working with or loving each other. It is in the garden that we discover what travel truly is. We do not journey to a garden, but by way of it. Genuine travel has no destination. Travelers do not go somewhere, but constantly discover they are somewhere else. Since gardening is a way not of subduing the indifference of nature, but of raising one's own spontaneity to respond to the disregarding vagaries and unpredictabilities of nature, we do not look on nature as a sequence of changing scenes, but look on ourselves as persons in passage. Nature does not change. It has no inside or outside. It is therefore not possible to travel through it. All travel is therefore change within the traveler, and it is for that reason that travelers are always somewhere else. To travel is to grow. Genuine travelers travel not to overcome distance, but to discover distance. It is not distance that makes travel necessary, but travel that makes distance possible. Distance is not determined by the measurable length between objects, but by the actual differences between them. The motels around the airports in Chicago and Atlanta are so little different from the motels around the airports of Tokyo and Frankfurt that all essential distances dissolve in likeness. What is truly separated is distinct. It is unlike. The only true voyage would be not to travel through 100 different lands with the same pair of eyes, but to see the same land through 100 different pairs of eyes. Proust. A gardener, whose attention is ever on the spontaneities of nature, acquires the gift of seeing differences, looks always for the merest changes in plant growth or in the composition of the soil, the emerging population of insects and earthworms. So will gardeners, as parents, see changes of the smallest subtlety in their children, or as teachers see the signs of an increasing skill and possibly wisdom in their students. A garden, a family, a classroom, any place of human gathering whatsoever, will offer no end of variations to be observed, each an arrow pointing toward yet more changes. But these observed changes are not theatrically amusing to genuine gardeners. They dramatically open themselves to a renewed future. So, too, with those who look everywhere for difference, who see the earth as source, who celebrate the genius in others, who are not prepared against but for surprise. I have traveled far in Concord. Thoreau. 89. Since machinery requires force from without, its use always requires a search for consumable power. When we think of nature as resource, it is as a resource for power. As we preoccupy ourselves with machinery, nature is increasingly thought of as a reservoir of needed substances. It is a quantity of materials that exists to be consumed, chiefly in our machines. Being undivided, nature cannot be used against itself. We do not therefore consume it or exhaust it. We simply rearrange our societal patterns in a way that reduces our ability to respond creatively to the existing patterns of spontaneity. That is, to use the societal expression, we create waste. Waste, of course, is by no means unnatural. The trash and garbage of a civilization do not befoul nature, they are nature. But in a form, society no longer is able to exploit for its own ends. Society regards its waste as an unfortunate but necessary consequence of its activities. What is left when we have made essential societal goods available? But waste is not the result of what we have made. It is what we have made. Waste plutonium is not an indirect consequence of the nuclear industry. It is a product of that industry. 90. Waste is unveiling. As we find ourselves standing in garbage that we know is our own, we find also that it is garbage we have chosen to make, and having chosen to make it, could choose not to make it. Because waste is unveiling, we remove it. We place it where it is out of sight. We either find uninhabited areas where waste can be disposed of, or fill them with our refuse until they become uninhabitable. Since a flourishing society will vigorously exploit its natural resources, it will produce correspondingly great quantities of trash, and quickly its uninhabited lands will overflow with waste, threatening to make the society's own habitation into a wasteland. Because waste is unveiling, it is not only placed out of sight, it is declared a kind of anti-property. No one owns it. Part of the contradiction in the phenomenon of waste is that treating nature as though it belongs to us, we must soon treat nature as though it belongs to no one. Not only does no one own waste, no one wants it. Instead of competing to possess these particular products, we compete to dispossess them. We force it on others less able to rid themselves of it. Trash accumulates in slums. Sewage runs downstream. Airborne acid drifts hundreds of miles, settling on the lands of those powerless to halt its disposal into the atmosphere. Thousands of square miles of farmlands have been laid waste by the construction of multi-lane highways, or submerged by dams whose water is used to flush waste from distant cities. Waste is the anti-property that becomes the possession of losers. It is the emblem of the untitled. Waste is unveiling because it persists in showing itself as waste, and as our waste. If waste is the result of our indifference to nature, it is also the way we experience the indifference of nature. Waste is therefore a reminder that society is a species of culture. Looking about at the wasteland into which we have converted our habitation, we can plainly see that nature is not whatever we want it to be. But we can also plainly see that society is only what we want it to be. It is a consequence of this contradiction that the more waste a society produces, the more unveiling that waste is, and thus the more vigorously must a society deny that it produces any waste at all. The more it must dispose, or hide, or ignore, its detritus. 91. Since the attempt to control nature is, at its heart, the attempt to control other persons, we can expect societies to be less patient with those cultures which express some degree of indifference to societal goals and values. It is this repeated parallel that brings us to see that the society that creates natural waste creates human waste. Waste persons are those no longer useful as resources to a society for whatever reason, and have become apatrides, or non-citizens. Waste persons must be placed out of view, in ghettos, slums, reservations, camps, retirement villages, mass graves, remote territories, strategic hamlets, all places of desolation and uninhabitable. We live in a century whose master players have created many millions of such superfluous persons. Rubinstein. A people does not become superfluous by itself, any more than natural waste creates itself. It is society that declares some persons to be waste. Human trash is not an unfortunate burden on a society, an indirect result of its proper conduct. It is its direct product. European settlers in the American, African, and Asian continents did not happen to come upon populations of unwanted persons nature had thrust in their way. They made them superfluous by way of some of the most important and irreversible principles of their societies. Strictly speaking, waste persons do not exist outside the boundaries of a society. They are not society's enemies. One does not go to war against them, as one goes to war against another society. Waste persons do not constitute an alternative or threatening society. They constitute an unveiling culture. They are therefore purged. A society cleanses itself of them. 92. When society is unveiled, when we see that it is whatever we want it to be, that it is a species of culture with nothing necessary in it, by no means a phenomenon of nature or a manifestation of instinct, nature is no longer shaped and fitted into one or another set of societal goals. Unveiled, we stand before a nature whose only face is its hidden self-origination, its genius. We see nature as genius when we see as genius. We understand nature as source when we understand ourselves as source. We abandon all attempts at an explanation of nature when we see that we cannot be explained, when our own self-origination cannot be stated as fact. We behold the irreducible otherness of nature when we behold ourselves as its other. 93. For the infinite player, seeing as genius, nature is the absolutely unlike. The infinite player recognizes nothing on the face of nature. Nature displays not only its indifference to human existence, but its difference as well. Nature offers no home. Although we become gardeners in response to its indifference, nature does nothing of itself to feed us. In Jewish and Islamic mythology, God provided us with a garden, but did not, indeed could not, do the gardening for us. It was only a garden because we could respond to it, because we could be responsible for it. Our responsibility lay in noting its variabilities and discrete features. We were to name the animals, separating one from the other. This garden was not a machine-like device automatically providing food for us. Neither were we machine-like, driven from without and destined from within. According to this myth, God did breathe life into us, but in order to continue living, we had to do our own breathing. But responsibility for the garden does not mean that we can make a garden of nature, as though it were a poema of which we could take possession. A garden is not something we have over which we stand as gods. A garden is a poiesis, a receptivity to variety. A vision of differences that leads always to a making of differences. The poet joyously suffers the unlike, reduces nothing, explains nothing, possesses nothing. We stand before genius in silence. We cannot speak it, we can only speak as it. Yet, though I speak as genius, I cannot speak for genius. I cannot give nature a voice in my script. I cannot give others a voice in my script, without denying their own source, their originality. To do so is to cease responding to the other, to cease being responsible. No one and nothing belong in my script. The homelessness of nature, its utter indifference to human existence, disclose to the infinite player that nature is the genius of the dramatic. Chapter 7. Myth provokes explanation, but accepts none of it. 94. Myth provokes explanation, but accepts none of it. Where explanation absorbs the unspeakable into the speakable, myth reintroduces the silence that makes original discourse possible. Explanations establish islands, even continents of order and predictability. But these regions were first charted by adventurers whose lives are narratives of exploration and risk. They found them only by mythic journeys into the wayless open. When the less adventuresome settlers arrive later to work out the details and domesticate these spaces, they easily lose the sense that all this firm knowledge does not expunge myth, but floats in it. Few discoveries were greater than Copernicus's, for they projected an order into the heavens that no one has successfully challenged. Many thought then, and some still think, that this great statement of truth dispelled clouds of myth that had kept humankind in retarding darkness. What Copernicus dispelled, however, were not myths, but other explanations. Myths lie elsewhere. To see where, we do not look at the facts in Copernicus's works. We look for the story in his stating them. Knowledge is what successful explanation has led to. The thinking that sent us forth, however, is pure story. Copernicus was a traveler who went with 100 pairs of eyes, daring to look again at all that is familiar in the hope of vision. What we hear in this account is the ancient saga of the solitary wanderer, the Peregrinus, who risks anything for the sake of surprise. True, at a certain point he stopped to look and may have ended his journey as a master player, setting down bounded fact. But what resounds most deeply in the life of Copernicus is the journey that made knowledge possible, and not the knowledge that made the journey successful. That myth does not accept the explanations it provokes, we can see in the boldness with which thinkers in any territorial endeavor re-examine the familiar for a higher seeing. Indeed, the very liveliness of a culture is determined not by how frequently these thinkers discover new continents of knowledge, but by how frequently they depart to seek them. A culture can be no stronger than its strongest myths. 95. A story attains the status of myth when it is retold, and persistently retold, solely for its own sake. If I tell a story as a way of bracing up an argument or amusing an audience, I am not telling it for its own sake. To tell a story for its own sake is to tell it for no other reason than that it is a story. Great stories have this feature. To listen to them and learn them is to become their narrators. Our first response to hearing a story is the desire to tell it ourselves. The greater the story, the greater the desire. We will go to considerable time and inconvenience to arrange a situation for its retelling. It is as though the story is itself seeking the occasion for its recurrence. making use of us as its agents. We do not go out searching for stories for ourselves. It is rather the stories that have found us for themselves. Great stories cannot be observed any more than an infinite game can have an audience. Once I hear the story, I enter into its own dimensionality. I inhabit its space at its time. I do not therefore understand the story in terms of my experience, but my experience in terms of the story. Stories that have the enduring strength of myths reach through experience to touch the genius in each of us. But experience is the result of this generative touch, not its cause. So far is this the case, that we can even say that, if we cannot tell a story about what happened to us, nothing has happened to us. It was not Freud's theory of the unconscious that led him to Oedipus, but the myth of Oedipus that shaped the way he listened to his patients. The theory of instincts, he wrote, is so to say our mythology. So too then the theory of the unconscious that follows from it, and the superego and the ego. This is a mythology of such poetic strength that it has altered not only the way we understand our experience, but our experience itself. Who of us has not known a crisis of ego, the disturbing presence of unwanted feelings, or the anxious recoil from a more polymorphously embodied sexuality? These experiences are not described by Freud, the dispassionate scientist. They are made possible by Freud, the mythic dreamer. As myths make individual experience possible, they also make collective experience possible. Whole civilizations rise from stories, and can rise from nothing else. It is not the historical experience of Jews that makes the Torah meaningful. The Torah is no more a description of the creation of the earth and early Jewish life than the theory of instincts is a description of the psyches of a handful of bourgeois Viennese of the early 20th century. The Torah is not the story of the Jews. It is what makes Judaism a story. We tell myths for their own sake, because they are stories that insist on being stories and insist on being told. We come to life at their touch. However seriously we might regard them as so much inert poema and attach metaphysical meanings to them, they spring back out of their own vitality. When we look into a story to find its meaning, it is always a meaning we have brought with us to look at. Myths are like magic trees in the garden of culture. They do not grow on, but out of, the silent earth of nature. The more we strip these trees of their fruit or prune them back to our favored design, the more imposing and fecund they become. Myths, told for their own sake, are not stories that have meanings, but stories that give meanings. 96. Storytellers become metaphysicians or ideologists when they come to believe they know the entire story of a people. This is history theatricalized, with the beginning and end in plain sight. A psychoanalyst who looks for the Freudian myth in patients imposes a filter that lets through nothing the psychoanalyst was not prepared to find. The psychotherapeutic relationship will become horizontal only when both patient and therapist realize that the Freudian myth does not determine the meaning of what happens between them, but offers the possibility that their relationship will have a story of its own. The Freudian myth does not therefore repeat itself in their relationship, but resonates in it. Those Jews who claim the right to certain territories on the basis of a biblical promise, those Christians who believe the Russians are the great evil armies foreseen in biblical prophecies of the end of the world, repeat the Bible, but do not resonate with it. We resonate with myth when it resounds in us. A myth resounds in me when its voice is heard in mine, but not heard as mine. I do not resonate when I quote Jeremiah, or when I speak as Jeremiah, but only when Jeremiah speaks in a way that touches an original voice in me. The speech of New Yorkers resonates not because they talk like New Yorkers, but because when they talk, we hear New York in their voice. The resonance of myth collapses the apparent distinction between the story told by one person to another and the story of their telling and listening. It is one thing for you to tell me the story of Muhammad. It is quite another for me to tell the story of your telling me about Muhammad. Ordinarily, we confine the story to the words of the speaker. But in doing so, we treat it as a story quoted, not a story told. In your